Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here is what is ahead today. The tech wreck. Big names like Apple, Amazon, and Facebook getting hit this week as rates continue to climb. Is this a buying opportunity? That's the question of the afternoon. Plus, forget valuations and fundamentals. Investors looking for a new type of research these days. Reddit mentions. We're going to speak with a company doing just that and selling it to hundreds of clients. And former Citigroup chairman and CEO Sandy Weill is going to be with us. We're going to talk about his new philanthropic effort in the world of healthcare. We'll also talk with him about the Reddit revolution and so much more. But let's begin with the markets this hour. My good friend Dom Chu has more on that. Dom.
Andrew, it wasn't like this earlier this morning when we were together on Squawk, but this is a legitimate market sell-off on an intraday basis now. We are at the lows of the session for the major indexes, a 500-point decline for the Dow. It's roughly about 1.5% down there. The S&P 500 taking it even harder now, 38.38 the last trade there, off over 2%, and the real underperformer having its worst day on an intraday basis since all the way back in October is the NASDAQ Composite. Off 3.25% here. So the NASDAQ, a real focus here for many traders. By the way, at the highs of the session, we were flat on the S&P. We're now down 87 points. Some themes to keep an eye on in trading so far today. The 10-year note yield. Got to go all the way back to February of last year to get to this near 1.5% yield that we're seeing in the benchmark 10-year Treasury note. So again, interest rates continuing to be a big part of that discussion. As we look at where the ripple effects are, some of the places that we're seeing the biggest effects are in some of the consumer names. These are earnings-related declines now. Best Buy, Domino's Pizza, and Norwegian all coming out with some kind of an earnings report that disappointed investors in some way. 9% declines for Best Buy, Domino's down 8.5%, and then Norwegian Cruise Lines down 8.5% as well. So again, consumers very much in focus. And of course, you mentioned it, the Reddit meme stocks, the internet board stocks, all of those ones in focus today. GameStop, just over the last year, massive moves of the volatility. We know that. But these guys have all been rising. Cost, AMC, GameStop, very big moves in intraday trading so far today. So I know that, Andrew, you guys will be going more into that discussion later on the show. But for now, I'll send things back over to you.
Thanks, Dom. Great to see you as always. As Dom just mentioned, a major move for the 10-year Treasury yield. And we got to talk about what it means, hitting its highest level in over a year today. In fact, the 10-year reached above the S&P 500's dividend yield of 1.48%. Interest rates have been growing along with optimism over the recovery, but it is also causing weakness in what was once super hot areas of the market. My next guest says a V-shaped rebound may actually lead to lower valuations. I want to bring in Michael Darda. He's the chief market strategist and chief economist at MKM Partners. Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say, Michael. The question is, if the 10-year continues at this pace, are we just going to see the tech wreck continue? I mean, how bad can this get?
Yeah, Andrew, I think so, at least for a while. The areas of the market at most risk here, I think, are these super highly valued areas, in particular technology stocks in the NASDAQ 100. You have about 40% of that market trading at a double-digit price-to-sales ratio. So, you know, those stocks are at risk with rising discount rates. And then you guys have been covering closely the frenzy with the Reddit stocks, and certainly we see a lot of momentum in the SPAC market and then the cryptocurrency area. All of these areas, I think, could come under significant further pressure if the 10-year continues to rise in yield. It's happening for good reasons, but all things equal, it will tend to lower valuations if those discount rates are moving
higher. But let's just be clear. You're betting the 10-year goes higher, which means you're betting the market goes lower. Does that mean you're getting into cash? Does that mean there are defensive stocks that you like? What do you do?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I still think there's a lot of upside in what we'd consider value. So if we look at the areas that have performed the best just year to date, it's energy and financials. There's probably more upside there. The valuations aren't super commanding or demanding. And if you go all the way back to the trough in the 10-year yield last summer, The leadership in the S&P 500 has been dominated by some of these more value-oriented but still cyclical areas. So I still think there's room to run there. But, you know, energy is a tiny share of the S&P 500 market cap. And so we could have a year where the overall indices really tread water, even though earnings are strong, because higher market interest rates end up pressuring valuations in some of these super elevated PE sectors.
Okay, let's talk Reddit for a second, because I still don't understand it. Call me crazy, call me old fashioned. I don't understand. I know they're trying to kill the suits. That's all I know. What do you think has happened in the last 24 hours?
Well, your guess is as good as mine there. I think we're all a bit confused. You know, talking to family members and friends, I'm getting a lot of questions about, you know, the stocks that are a focus in these Reddit forums and also cryptocurrencies. So all I'm telling retail investors that are friends and family members is just be careful. Speculate if you want to speculate, but it should be a super tiny portion of your portfolio, and don't expect any of this stuff to be a one-way bet. You know, so caution is certainly needed here.
I know I'm going to get killed saying this by the Reddit community, but is there any way this ends well? Is there any way this ends well?
You know, I think in any asset class that has incredibly high volatility, you're going to have some people get burnt. Even if it does end well for a specific company, you know, you will have investors, whether they're institutional or retail, not getting the timing right. And you've seen the stories about some of these individuals that have taken out huge bank loans and ruined themselves because of trying to time a single stock bet, and it's a gigantic portion of their net worth. And so hopefully, you know, you won't get criticized for warning people against that. It's just not, you know, it's not a good steward, being a good steward of your funds, if you're taking gigantic risks in super volatile stocks with a huge portion of your net worth. Not a good idea for anybody.
Okay, so final question. Just put the market and the economy in context with what we're seeing with Reddit. Are we ringing the bell here? Is this a bubblicious moment here? Do we think there's 2, 3, 4 more years of a bull run, or is this the sign of froth?
Yeah, I do think we have certainly signs of froth in particular markets. You know, 1987 is one example of a booming economy, a lot of liquidity, and a big rise in market interest rates, 300 basis points over the course of the year. The market didn't seem to care for a while, and then it started to care, and we obviously had a big crash. I don't think it's going to be 1987 all over again for the overall S&P 500, but certainly for some of these super speculative markets, it very well could be.
Okay. Michael Darda, great to see you. Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Meantime, on the other side of this, we've got a news alert right now. The bond market, 7-year bond up for auction. This is the 10-year cross is now 1.5%. Rick Santelli tracking the action at the CME. What's the demand like right now, Rick?
How's this? I'm holding my nose for anybody watching the radio. This was not a good auction. Matter of fact, this might be one of the worst auctions I've graded ever. First of all, it's $62 billion, which is tied for the record size. The last auction for sevens was 62. 2 years ago, these auctions were like $32 billion. Just to give you an idea, the yield at the Dutch auction was 1.195, which is like 4 basis points above where it was trading in the when-issued market. Higher yield, lower price. That pretty much says it all. That gives you your D-minus right there. Now, when we go through the numbers, it's sort of shocking. The bid to cover, 2.04. I couldn't even find a 2.04 since the 7 years been around. 38.1 was indirects. That's the worst since Thanksgiving of 2013. And if we look at the only bright spot, direct bidders at 22.1, best since December of 19. Hedge funds, mutual funds, they jumped in to some extent, but nobody else did, which meant primary dealers took the most they've ever taken since September 2014, a whisker under 40%. These numbers are atrocious, but it shouldn't be shocking considering how much higher yields have moved over the last several weeks. Andrew, back to you.
Okay, I need a prediction, though, on the 10-year, because everybody's going crazy about where that's trading at right now. We just hit over 1.5 here, and the whole equity market is trading off of it.
Yeah, no, I think we're going to definitely do some pausing in the 150 to 155 area. But I think ultimately, Andrew, I told Joe this about a month and a half ago, ultimately 1.67 is my next real resistance level in 10-year note yields. But don't underestimate the low 150s. We have some key bottoms there from about a year and a half ago.
Okay, Rickster, thank you. We'll watch this space. Meantime, this Reddit fuel trade driving GameStop and so many other stocks higher while the broader markets sell off again since this phenomenon started last month. Hedge funds and investment banks have been turning to alternative data providers, in this case, Thinkum, to help them get an edge on this volatile trade. Thinkum keeps tabs on companies trending on social media. And on January 27th, it started offering clients the most mentioned stocks on Reddit. Joining us right now is Justin Zenn. He's the co-founder and president of Thinkum. Good afternoon. Help us understand what you're seeing on Reddit. I want to talk about the service you offer, but in the last 24 hours, what have you seen?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. In the last 24 hours, we saw the number of occurrences of mentions for GameStop spike. It actually started spiking about 4 days ago, and the volume today has been insane. But we see a huge spike in advance of the run-up in the stock yesterday.
So, but what, the thing that I don't understand, I was spending a lot of time on Reddit yesterday, and it's funny because Dave Portnoy was doing his thing online, and he was saying, does somebody just press the button and say go? Who do I talk to who's going to tell me that this is the moment? This is the moment. I mean, it happened with such force and such intensity so quickly. From your data, you think you could predict that?
So we don't claim to, let's say, predict anything. We provide a service where investors can track when the number of mentions on Reddit for any particular stock is increasing, right? So, we don't interpret or analyze the data. We don't claim the stock will go up. But what we are seeing is that there's a lot of chatter around the stock today. And we do this for many other data sets as well. And if you're an investor, then you need to pay attention.
How much of the real action, though, in terms of the communication that's happening among this sort of social media-enabled world, do you think is happening still on Reddit? Or do you think they've actually gone to private rooms in other places?
Yeah, sure. So Reddit is, one very important site. That's where most of the action has happened. But we do provide a platform with about 30 data sets. We track not just social media. We track data sets such as product pricing, where companies opening locations. So investors are holistically trying to get a better view on what a company is doing and what their sentiment is, amongst the retail investors in this case. But Reddit is one oversized sample recently, but there are many other data trails that good investors pay attention to.
This has to be great for your business, but you think it's good for the markets?
I don't know if it's good for the markets. I think from our perspective, there's a ton of information on the web that's very actionable. Someone has to collect and organize this information. And, in a way that makes the markets more efficient, everyone has greater transparency. That's our mission for why we started Thinkum.
Do you imagine, by the way, that you're going to get a call from the SEC asking to use your data to figure out whether investors are forming groups online? Can you actually see that kind of information?
We have gotten many inquiries from government bodies, which I can't comment on specifically. But we've received a tremendous amount of interest, not just from investors. We've been contacted by corporations, government bodies, academia. The interest has been substantial. It's the most I've seen in 6 years of doing this.
Well, Justin, you seem to be situated perfectly in the middle of it all. We appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Good to see you. When we come back on the other side of the break, the red-hot pizza trade appears to be cooling off today as Papa John sinks on the back of earnings. We're going to speak with the CEO about demand, adjusting to COVID, and what is next. And tech takes a back seat. Rising yields has investors selling the sector and rotating into energy and financials. Is this a buying opportunity? That's the question we're going to ask. And as we head out, here's a look at the biggest losers in the NASDAQ 100. Looking at NVIDIA, Booking, NetSF, and Lam Research. The Exchange coming back right after this.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to the Exchange this afternoon. Shares of Papa John's sharply lower on an earnings miss amid higher costs. Kate Rogers joins me now with a closer look and a special guest. Kate.
Hey, Andrew. Well, a mixed quarter for Papa John's, EPS coming in at 40 cents adjusted. Due to those bonuses paid out to frontline workers during the quarter, revenues a beat at $470 million for Q4. Same store sales up 13.5% in North America for the quarter and up 17.6% for full year, as pizza, of course, was a big hit with consumers during the pandemic. We do want to bring in Papa John's CEO Rob Lynch joining us now for a CNBC exclusive. Rob, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So we'll get right to it. You hired 30,000 workers over the last year, and you did pay out $2.7 million in those bonuses to frontline workers. Tell us why that was worth the investment, how you'll hang on to those workers moving ahead.
Okay, Papa John's has never been in a better position, and that's because of the contributions of all of our employees across the country and across the globe who've been working tirelessly to take care of their communities in this time of need. And we felt like it was really important to make sure that we took good care of them. We're always going to make the right decisions for our employees who are make the right decisions to take care of our customers. We take pride in that. And, you know, we're very happy with the decisions we've made. And that's a long-term decision. We're focused on creating long-term shareholder value. And, you know, if the markets react negatively to us taking care of our employees in the short term, I'm sure they'll be back when they see the positive results that those employees drive in the long term.
So pizza, of course, has been a big winner over the past year. Your stock was one of the best performers in 2020. Now, you focus a lot on menu innovation over the last year and throughout your tenure as CEO here. How do you hang on to these customers as we do move into and navigate a new normal as vaccines roll out, perhaps, you know, consumers move away from delivery and back in towards eating in-house at restaurants?
You know, we haven't changed our plans at all during the pandemic. We've just accelerated all of our efforts up against achieving what we believe to be the best long-term version of Papa John's. And really, it does start with our food. We believe that we invest in better ingredients that delivers better pizza. And I think that gives us a platform to innovate off of that you know, makes us differentiated in the marketplace. Last year, we launched Papadias to great success. Shaq-a-roni was a big hit. This year in Q1, at the beginning of this year, we've launched our stuffed crust pizza, which is our biggest innovation ever. And we couldn't be happier with the results that we're seeing both from a sales standpoint and a customer feedback standpoint. So we're going to continue driving innovation, making that a big part of our strategy moving forward.
Store expansion also on the horizon here. Your AUVs hit $1 million for the first time this past quarter. I know you talked about a few different areas on the conference call that you'll be focusing on in terms of expansion. Where do you foresee the biggest opportunity here?
Really, it's everywhere, Kate, you know, both domestically and internationally. We're working with our franchisees who've experienced a huge positive movement in their unit economics over the last year. Higher AUVs, you mentioned we crossed the $1 million threshold as a system. The flow throughs on those AUVs are fantastic. Our franchisees are doing really well and they want to invest in the brand. They believe in the long term viability of our business and our plan, and they want to grow. Internationally, we have a lot of white space. We operate in about half as many countries as our core competitors, and we think there's a lot of white space to go after, both in the markets that we currently compete in, as well as in markets that we don't currently compete in. So really, it's a global opportunity for Papa John's. Among the big three players, we have the most development opportunity in white space.
Aggregator sales increased fourfold. We talk a lot about using aggregators, not using aggregators, particularly in the pizza space. How do you take those customers and then move them over into your loyalty program? How important will that be to the brand moving ahead?
It's very important. We made a choice way back when I came to the brand that we were going to be where the customer wants to order. And what we've found is that customers who come through the aggregator platforms are new customers. It's very incremental. They're customers that haven't traditionally ordered from Papa John's. What we're seeing is a huge influx of those new customers. It's very exciting, but it's even more exciting when they try our products for the first time. They come in and they fall in love with the food. They fall in love with our innovative new LTOs. And then they come over to the loyalty program where we can continue to engage with them on an ongoing basis and make sure that we're meeting their unique needs.
Great. Rob Lynch, thank you so much for being here. Papa John's CEO, we appreciate it. Andrew, back over to you.
Thank you, Kate.
Kate, thank you. Thank you for that great interview. Coming up on the other side of this break, Apple shares sinking in the past month, down nearly 15%. Is this the buying opportunity that many were waiting for, or is there more pain to come? We're going to ask that question and hopefully answer it. And take a look at the home builders today, which are getting slammed as rates rise. You got LGI Homes, Dr. Horton's, Lennar. They are the big losers at the moment.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Stocks, they are selling off amid a surge in bond yields. Right now, the Dow off the lows, but still down 400 points. S&P off nearly 2%. The NASDAQ, the big loser, down 2.5%. The 10-year crossing 1.5% just a short while ago. All 11 sectors are lower, with consumer discretionary and information technology leading those declines. And the travel and leisure stocks, they're pulling back today as well. TripAdvisor down nearly 10%. Royal Caribbean, Marriott, United Airlines, all sliding. For more on this market sell-off, I want to bring in Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group. Peter, what do you make of what's happening here? It's the 10-year. It's the 10-year that's doing it. The question is, which way is it going? And what's the Fed going to do about it?
You're right. It's all about yields. And today, it's not just about the 10-year. The rise in rates is now filtering into a rise in shorter-term rates, which the Fed is supposed to control. The Fed, by having the overnight rate at zero and buying $80 billion of treasuries per month with the average maturity about 5 years, we're seeing a spike in the five-year yield in a large way. The Treasury sold five-year paper yesterday at 62 basis points. That yield one day later is at 80 basis points. So the Fed, because of their uber dovishness, the market is now calling that out. The market is now saying the inflation pressures we're seeing, the vaccines we're seeing that are being highly effective, that your dovishness is just not going to work here, and we're going to shift the interest rate curve with or without you.
Okay, well, if that's the case, what you're effectively saying is that the Fed's losing control here. So if you're Jay Powell and you're watching this right now, What do you do, and frankly, how much do you care, given the priorities that he's made relatively clear, even over the last couple of days?
The Fed has two choices. They either fight this, they try to fight the market by maintaining their dovishness and possibly increasing QE or shifting the maturity profile of QE and going further out in the curve to try to contain this, or do they accept this and they start sounding less dovish? I'm not saying that they're going to go shift and say, you know, we're going to raise rates sooner rather than later or taper rather than later, because there's no way they're going to do that. But the Fed is now being put on notice by the market that they need to get, that they're in the process of losing control of the bond market. They lose control of the bond market, they lose control of the stock market, and I don't think that's a situation they want to be in. So,
Peter,
it will be really interesting to see how Powell responds.
Do you think Powell reads it the way you do? Do you think he's sitting there watching you talking right now, saying, I've just lost control of the market?
No. Right now, they're saying, okay, yields are rising because that's a good thing. They're rising for a good reason. They're rising because of the vaccine hopes, and that the we're approaching the spring and things are going to start reopening and blah, blah, blah. So that's how they're viewing it. What I don't think they appreciate is the rapidity of this move. I mean, these are rather sharp increases in a very short period of time. And it's not just in the U.S. This is happening globally. The Australian 10-year yield is up 50 basis points in 2 weeks. That's with the Reserve Bank of Australia doing QE. So the world is tightening monetary policy. And in order to control that rise in longer-term rates, the Fed and other central bankers may have to pivot on what they think about short-term rates and QE. But like I said before, they either are going to fight it or they're going to embrace it and try to control it.
Okay. Peter Bookvar, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for your insight and perspective. We'll see what Jay Powell does next. But what we're going to do next is go to Rahel Solomon for a CNBC News update. Rahel.
Hi, Andrew. Hello, everyone. Here's what's happening at this hour. The acting chief of the U.S. Capitol Police says that they did prepare for the January 6th assault, but that the 800 pro-Trump rioters were just more than they expected.
There's evidence that some of those who stormed the Capitol were organized, but there's also evidence that a large number were everyday Americans who took on a mob mentality because they were angry and desperate. It is the conduct of this latter group that the department was not prepared for.
And former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm will be President Biden's energy secretary. The Senate has confirmed her with a 64-35 vote. Granholm has promoted clean energy tech as an answer to jobs being lost in fossil fuel-related industries. And Costco raising its minimum wage to $16 per hour. CEO Craig Jelinek made the announcement at a Senate hearing on wage levels at big companies. That is our CNBC News update. But Andrew, the CEO, is saying there that it's not just good for employees, but of course it's good for business. It helps them with low turnover. I'll send it back to you.
Fascinating, Rahel. Thanks so much. When we come back on the other side of this, financial industry titan Sandy Weill is going to join us. He's teaming up with Genentech and Roche to help accelerate the development of treatments for neurological disorders. We're going to talk to Sandy Weill and Genentech CEO as well next about, of course, all of this. And we'll also talk to him about the markets and, yes, the Reddit revolution. And take a look at the semi stocks right now. They're falling across the board. The ETF that tracks the sector, SMH, sinking more than 4%. NVIDIA among the worst performers, down 7%. We got a lot more on this market sell-off when we come back. Welcome back to The Exchange. We've got a news alert right now on Twitter, and Julia Borstein's got the details. Julia.
Well, Andrew, Twitter just gave some insight into its potential subscription service that is in the works. This is happening at its Analyst Day, which is underway right now. The company announcing is exploring the idea of super followers and tipping. So users could theoretically pay to be a super follower of someone on Twitter to get exclusive content. That person would share the revenue with Twitter. Also announcing new communities, which would be similar to Facebook groups. That's obviously been very successful for Facebook. Twitter shares are up nearly 7% today on the company announcing some revenue and user goals pegged to that Analyst Day. Andrew?
So, Julia, how much are you going to charge for people to follow you?
Well, Andrew, I don't know if it's going to be up to me or if Twitter is going to set those rates, but this could be very interesting. There's a lot of talk now about the creator economy, the idea that Snap and Instagram and all of these different platforms are going to figure out how to let creators monetize their relationships with their fans.
Okay, Julia Borstein, thanks for bringing us that news. Meantime, we have some other big news today in the neuroscience space. The Weill Neuro Hub is partnering with Genentech and Roche to tackle some of society's most pressing health problems. University of California, San Francisco, and UC Berkeley will receive up to $53 million from Genentech over the course of 10 years with the goal of speeding up development of drugs to treat brain diseases. For more, I'm joined by former Citigroup chairman and CEO Sandy Weill and Genentech CEO Alexander Hardy, and our own Meg Terrell is with us to kick it off. Meg.
Andrew, thank you so much. Gentlemen, great to have you here to talk about neuroscience. It's almost a breath of fresh air to be taking a little bit of a break from COVID right now. Alexander, maybe I'll start with you. You know, putting $53 million into the Weill Neuro Hub, why is this the right investment for Genentech? Do you see this as kind of an important moment where neuroscience research can really be kicking off?
Yes, I absolutely do, Meg. First off, thanks very much for having me on. I mean, this is a tremendously exciting partnership that we're kicking off today. Neuroscience, I mean, we all understand the profound need for better treatments in all these diseases, from Alzheimer's to ALS to autism to Parkinson's. And the science is exciting, but the science is also very challenging. And we really need to bring the best minds together to tackle these enormous challenges. And with this collaboration, we're bringing the best minds in academia together with the best minds in industry in neuroscience. And we're going to be tackling together these problems. And I'm really confident that we're going to make significant progress as a result in developing new treatments for really these devastating conditions.
Well, Sandy, you know, I want to bring it over to you, and just to better understand your interest in the neuroscience area, I understand, you know, the NeuroHub is among multiple investments that your family foundation has made in this space. More than $300 million you've invested in trying to advance neuroscience work. What do you see about the space? Why does it interest you? What do you hope you can accomplish in somewhat near term?
I think what interests me the most is that neuroscience is way behind.
He can come in, but I can come back later.
Relative to what's happened with cancer, what's happened with HIV, what's happened with cardio, where people are living longer because we've made a lot of discoveries. And the brain is the most complicated part of the human body. And we are way, way behind. People are living longer. So it's gonna be a very, very big problem if we don't make headway. And I think that the most important thing is, as Alexander said, is to merge together the academia with the industry that works in this area, because partnerships and collaborations are going to be very important, because discoveries are so important, so expensive.
They absolutely are. And in this space, more than others, we have just seen so much failure across diseases of the brain. Alexander, I wonder your thoughts on this moment we're in right now, particularly when it comes to Alzheimer's disease. I know that Genentech has multiple programs in your pipeline focusing on beta amyloid, the buildups of plaque in the brain associated with Alzheimer's. Biogen's up at the FDA with the drug focusing on that target. You know, Lilly just had some unexpectedly positive results in this space. Do you feel like it's a renaissance for beta amyloid right now? And how important are the sort of events over the coming months from the FDA and those drugs for that space?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very, very exciting time in Alzheimer's. We do have, as you mentioned, a late stage program with two phase threes currently running. We'll be looking for the readout around 2022. And it's working on this particular pathway, the beta amyloid hypothesis. We also have research with other pathways we think may be important in Alzheimer's. So this we just regard this as an area where the unmet need is so significant. The science is challenging, but we think, you know, if not us, then who is going to make these sorts of investments over a long period of time to make the sort of advances which society clearly needs? So I think there's a number of different drugs, different MOAs to play out. And I'm cautiously optimistic. Clearly, the industry has struggled to bring new drugs to bear against Alzheimer's. But I think there's a lot.
Hey, Sandy, it's Andrew.
Pardon?
Hey, Sandy, it's Andrew Sorkin here. I just wanted to pivot the conversation, if we could, for a moment. You've done remarkable work in this space, but I also want to talk to you about the markets, given your long career on Wall Street and what you think is happening right now. I don't know if you noticed, but literally while the program's been on, the 10 years now over 1.5, we're starting to see tech stocks really sell off. And we've been talking about Bitcoin and lots of asset bubbles. What do you think's happening? How are you thinking about the economy right now?
I think the economy is beginning to improve. I think we still have a long way to go, but I think this new fiscal stimulus will be really very important, and I hope it passes soon. I think as you look at interest rates for the 10-year to be at 1.5, people are really losing money investing for 10 years at less than what the rate of inflation is. So I think that the interest rates have been low for longer than they should have been, and it's just making a catch up. But I think that rates at these levels and somewhat higher are not too high to take away the importance of the equity markets and the ability for them to continue to do well. I think we're seeing on the real extremes, lots of activity that really appears not to make much sense. I think it's terrific that younger people are getting interested in investing for their future. And I just hope that the companies that really working with younger people spend more to educate them so that they understand that really good investing is really long-term investing, and understanding what you're doing and understanding the companies that you invest your money in. And
you're referring to the action we're seeing in GameStop and apps like Robinhood, right?
That is correct.
And before we let you go, because I should ask, do you have a take on Bitcoin as somebody who lived in the banking world for so very long and has spent a lot of time thinking about the dollar and the Federal Reserve?
You know, I don't see how, personally, how it really makes sense. You can't have something that's going to be a currency that's used for exchange that is as volatile as Bitcoin is. And so I think I'm going to stick to the old-fashioned paper money.
Okay. Sandy, we appreciate you being with us. Alexander, thank you. And Meg, thank you.
Thank you, too.
Great to see all of you.
Appreciate it.
Talk to you guys soon. When we come back, tech taking it on the chin this week with Amazon, the biggest lagger, down more than 6%. Needham's Laura Martin joins us with what's behind the tech wreck and whether there's more pain ahead. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Stocks continue to sell off with tech among the worst performers today, with the big names seeing some of the biggest losses. Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, and Facebook all down or about 2% or more today as fears of rising rates seep into those averages. For more on why big tech seems to be taking the brunt, let's bring in Laura Martin, senior internet and media analyst at Needham & Company. Good afternoon to you, Laura. You look at what's happening here with the expectation that the 10-year may continue to go up. How much farther do we have to go down?
So, I mean, I think what's interesting is that I think what Needham is saying is that the equity market sell-off is about chasing yield, which is we have a battle going on between equities and the bond market, because today dividend yields for equities are 1.51% and the dividend and the bond yield is now 1.55%. By the way, just 6 months ago, the equity dividend yield was three times higher than the 10-year yield and the 10-year bond yield. And so what worries me is there's a lot of passive money out there that's been growing over the last 5 years as bond yields have continued to decline. And I worry that we don't know what's in those algorithms in terms of asset allocation. So I worry this kind of volatility is going to continue to be a curse of the equity markets now going forward as bond yields rise.
Okay, but let's just play this out and let's play it for long-term investing, not GameStop today and tomorrow.
Okay.
Do you look at these dips, if you will? Is this a buy the dip situation or not?
So for big tech, I absolutely think it is. I think these stocks are defensive. If you look at my screen, everything's down more than 2% except big tech, because it's hard for big tech to go down 2% because they're trillion-dollar companies. So I like them as a defensive play. Obviously, sometimes like Amazon's been dead money for 6 months because it's a source of money for the reopen trade, because Amazon was such a big beneficiary of COVID that people are selling that one to buy reopen trade kind of names. But no, I like them defensively because they're globally scaled. They are monopolies in the businesses they each created, and they are and they have pricing power. So no, we like them, and they're liquid. Right. So we really like the big tech for those defensive reasons.
Right. I'm sure management doesn't like you calling them monopolies, but investors do. Laura, let me ask you separately about a call that you've made around Netflix and Viacom.
Yeah, sure. So what we're saying is that the streaming assets inside of Viacom are worth more than the entire market cap today, which means you're getting the $5 billion of EBITDA from its legacy businesses sort of for free. And we understand that those are shrinking, which is not something Netflix doesn't have an aspect of its business that's shrinking. But over time, we think that the 2x revenue multiple that Viacom trades at will close the gap to the 8x multiple that Netflix trades at, because really Viacom is a streaming company, and I think a more effective streaming company with several competitive advantages over Netflix. And so we think those multiples will converge over the next
But just to be clear, you're saying sell Netflix now and buy Viacom. That's the play.
That's the play. That's what we're arguing.
And the Netflix multiple comes down to what, ultimately, in your mind? I know you think they're going to converge, but converge where?
So I think that Viacom will come up to 4, which is where the Walt Disney Company currently trades as a streaming asset. And so we think Viacom comes up to 4 or 5, and we think Netflix comes down from 8 to 5.
Okay, well, that would put Viacom stock at?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't done the numbers. Because it depends on what year you think that happens and what their earnings are.
How quickly do you think that happens?
5 years.
5 years, okay. Laura Martin, great to see you. Great insight on all of this. And hopefully we'll have this conversation a couple times between now and 5 years to see where things land. When we come back on the other side of this break, Texas, that massive power failure, sending natural gas and electricity prices soaring 10,000% or more. A look at how it got to this point and what needs to be done to fix it. And be sure to tune in to Mad Money tonight. Our good friend Jim Cramer, he has a huge show, and that's not hyperbole. I mean, just look at this. Are you looking at what's going on here? He's got executives from NVIDIA, Fisker, Twitter, Airbnb, and Salesforce. It's an all-star lineup. You do not want to miss it. It's at 6 p.m. tonight, Eastern Time. Back in a moment. Welcome back to The Exchange. Now the latest on the colossal failure of the Texas power grid last week. The state's primary grid operator, known as ERCOT, and a number of power companies are under fire at a Senate hearing today. Citizens looking for answers to a disaster that led to millions without power for days and more than 30 people confirmed dead. Brian Sullivan is live in Texas with more this afternoon. Brian.
Yeah, Andrew, you said it was no hyperbole talking about Jim's show tonight. Well, it's not hyperbole to say it was a colossal failure either, because ERCOT, which controls about 75% of the Texas power grid. By the way, Texas produces and consumes more power than any state in the United States. The power plants like this, by the way, and oil refineries, of course, that 48% of ERCOT's grid at one point was offline. So 48% of 75, you've got 5+ million households, far more millions of people who were without power at some point last week, during one of the worst cold stretches and winter storms in Texas history. It wasn't just that it was cold. It's been cold before. It's that it was cold for multiple days. Now, that set off a chain link of events, and we've talked about this failed and that failed. The power grid got overloaded. One of the subsidiary effects was that the wholesale price of natural gas and electricity, it's traded just like a stock or any other commodity, absolutely surged as much as 10,000 or more percent within a 24-hour period. What that means is that if you are contractually obligated to deliver that commodity or power, you had to go into the open market to buy it, which also means that there was a ripple effect beyond Texas, not just here. And in fact, we spoke with Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, who explained how what happened here and the price jump affected even her state thousands of miles to the north.
It gets to Minnesota, and you have the bigger utilities who are seeing massive price increases that they're paying for natural gas. And then you have the local munis that I'm in some ways most worried about, who are finding that they're burning through literally almost a year's worth of budget in just a few weeks because of these rapidly escalating prices.
Yeah, think about that. Your entire annual budget may have been spent in a week. What they're going to do, whether it's rate hikes to consumers, we don't know. By the way, Andrew, a lot of people saying who lost, who won. Well, the people of Texas definitely lost, and people lost their lives from a company perspective. Atmos Energy, they put in their 8K filing that they had to go out in the open market and buy up to $3 or $3.5 billion in natural gas. They might have to sell stock or debt to pay for that. And of course, rather infamously, I guess, Andrew, Comstock Resources, the company partially controlled by Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, basically said they were winners. They sold power and gas, rather, at these inflated prices. So hard to talk about winners and losers. The Texans certainly were the losers in all this, but there were certain companies from CNBC's angle that we follow that were involved in the story.
Brian, question for you, which is Texas has its own power grid largely cut off really from the rest of the country, right? I mean, that's been part of the issue. And so explain the connection between what's on the other side.
Yeah, and whether or not that's ever going to get fixed. They are themselves an island, so they could not get the power from other states. By the way, a lot of the states up north, Kansas, Oklahoma, they didn't have any. They had their own rolling blackouts, so not sure how much it would help this time. But there are calls for Texas to finally, you know, sort of stop being Texas, join the grid so that they can import power when they need to as well. Because, Andrew, the bottom line is this. You can't have the energy capital of America not having energy and people not having heat, power, or water, and literally losing their lives over the cold and no heat.
Brian Sullivan, thanks. Great to see you. Great reporting. That does it for us right here on The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.